Thank you. I think I'll hire you to go around and introduce me. My name is Vinay Shah, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi,
Roy. Hi, y'all. I came into this magnificent fellowship of ours February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas, and that's where my heritage comes from. My home group is the Stepped Up group in Los Angeles right now, and a magnificent group, and very active. I'm very active in Al-Anon. I have been since the day I walked in. Action seems to be the healer of us all. I think God keeps us real busy in here so he can fix things out there. I really do appreciate you giving me this real honor. This is an honor to be able to stand up and do anything in any fellowship, but especially ours. It's an honor. And to be able to talk about things that are so dear to my heart is an extreme honor. How many of you are here with a year or less in the program? Could I? Oh, wow, that's fantastic. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'll probably be talking to y'all because most everybody else knows this stuff. If they hadn't, I'll speak to Karen later. But I am absolutely, totally convinced that what we walk in, what we sit in these rooms, is absolutely a miracle. It's nothing short of a miracle. Now, before I got here, I assumed miracles were burning bushes. And most of us, if we walked outside right now and saw a burning bush, you know what we'd do? We would put it out. I mean, we would put it out. If we couldn't, we'd call somebody else to come put it out. Because we don't want a burning bush. Not really. What we want is something that we can understand, something we can feel, something we can touch. And I really do believe that's why God, in my opinion today, that's why God put us all here. And the incredible way we got here, I mean, drunks. Can you imagine? I mean, drunks. Falling down, puking, stinking, drunks is the whole reason for this miracle. I don't know if your alcoholics were like my alcoholics, and I've had lots of them. God, I just love them. You know, if I get rid of my current one, I'll go get another one. I just love alcoholics, you know. I'm geared for them. We just fit, you know. Just fit with an alcoholic. And to think that my ex-husband could have started something as worldwide as AA is I just get laughable about it. I think it's just hysterical. Now, I'm sure that's what Bill's wife and Dr. Bob's wife thought also. I mean, you got to know that if they knew today what we know, they'd probably really crack up. Because if you look at your husband or your daddy or your child and think, yeah, they're going to start some miracle around the world, yeah, right. That's exactly what happened. And briefly, I will go over that, especially for the newcomers. Our fellowship, Al-Anon, came out of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our roots. One of the reasons it's such a privilege for me to talk about this is the longer I'm here and the longer I'm around, I see us kind of sliding this way a little bit, maybe sliding that away a little bit. I have a little over 26 years in this program. I consider myself an old timer. I consider myself privileged to be here. And I consider myself that I have a responsibility, and the responsibility is to pass it on exactly the way I got it. Exactly the way I got it. And I'm privileged. I came from a hotbed of recovery. Texas is a hotbed. We were talking about it at lunch today. It's also been a privilege of mine, and I'm not sure how it happened. It just happened. A privilege of mine that I have been in every state in the United States, every state, with the exception of three or four, I think it is now, up on the East Coast. And I've been in all the provinces of Canada. I have been to Mexico. I have been to Al-Anon in all these areas, all over everywhere. And there are little hotbeds of enthusiasm all around this country. This is a hotbed of enthusiasm right here today. This is one. Because when you're looking and you're searching and you spend your Saturday afternoon in recovery, you're enthusiastic and this is a hotbed. My heritage came from a group called the Central Club. It was the first group in Lubbock, or one of the first. And the A, we had a big, we rented a big building, and AA's met in this room, and Al-Anon's met in this room, same nights, same times. They just split and went. Saturday night was the open meeting. The whole family came. There were speakers, and then afterwards we had bingo, and before there would be potlucks and known breakfasts, and they're just all kinds of things. Anybody got a Kleenex? I got. Thank you, Sandy. And we literally grew up together, because when I came in, it was a family disease. It was known as the family disease. We went for, thank you very much, we went for family recovery. And that's what has slowly, I have seen over the years, kind of change. Al-Anon seems to be and wants to be standing on its own 2 feet, which is fine. That's great. We should be. We're 2 separate entities, but we also cooperate. If we forget from whence we came, then I think we're in danger. And I think sometimes that may be where we're in danger now. The reason I say that is some of the changes that are going on are rather frightening to me. For instance, this last month there was the international convention, worldwide convention in San Diego. And Al-Anon, and I'm not sure who made the decision, because my group, my district, my delegate was never asked to vote on it, but Al-Anon decided, the World Service Office, to have, after this year of the international, to have 2 separate internationals now. Al-Anon will have their own. I think it's coming up in a couple of years in Utah. And we will not be together on the international level. And that saddens me. And I said, I don't know who made the decision, because I would have voted against it. Because we got sick together, let's get well together. So our heritage, I think, is important to finish that, to cover that. For those of you who are new, there was a drunk in New York. His name was Bill Wilson. He was a stockbroker. He was a wheeler. He was a dealer. He was a wild guy. He was from Vermont. And he went to New York, and he was married to a lady named Lois, and his alcoholism just got worse and worse and worse. And back in those days, the alcoholics went all the way to the bottom. I mean, there was nothing to stop their sliding, so they went all the way to the bottom. He was a drunk out in the streets, and his wife worked at a five and dime and took care of him, and that was what he did. At the same time, there was a group called the Oxford Group. It was kind of a religious group, and they met, and everybody came, and they all talked about their problems. They all helped each other get rid of their problems. There was a man named Ebby, who was an old friend of Bill's. He went to the Oxford Group. He got religion, and he got sober, and he went and talked to Bill. Bill went back to Akron, Ohio, on a business venture. When he got there, he was almost going to drink, and he'd been sober for several months. So he just picked up a telephone book, called people till he could find somebody, a preacher, somebody that would help him stay sober that day. And he got Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob was a proctologist, and a very drunk proctologist, but he was also from Vermont, and he was now living in Akron. So they had this little kind of a neat thing together. And for whatever reason, God inspired 2 drunks to get together this one particular day. Some of you have heard Dr. Bob's son. He just the cutest thing in the world. He drove his drunk daddy over there, and the drunk daddy was just going to stay 15 minutes. That's all he was going to stay, and that was it. So he got his son to drive him over there because he's shaking too hard. He got over there, and the son said he wouldn't leave. I mean, they sat there 4 hours talking. Now, Bill, being a wheeler dealer that he was, decided he wouldn't go back to work, so he lived with Dr. Bob about the next 3 months. And that was in the summer of 1935. And then the two of them, it just spread from there. Now, the reason I always tell that is because as they were getting help with each other, so was the family. The family started coming together and being with them, which is where our miracle begins. And this is where we kind of get off the track sometimes of not understanding that our miracle is with their miracle. And they wanted us. I think it was the third alcoholic that Bob and Bill talked with. His wife was there, and she was going to leave when they were going to go do something. And Dr. Bob turned to her and said, "Oh, no, we want you to come along with us, too. We have been separated far too long." And he was talking about the disease that separated us. So that's how they really got started. Bob and Bill decided they would start working with other drunks and see if this would help. And they did. And immediately the wives had to bring them. This was in the Depression era, so they didn't have any money, so they met in people's homes. When you meet in somebody's house today, we have every Thanksgiving, we have Thanksgiving at our house. And we have a lot of people. And as soon as Thanksgiving's over, we have a gratitude meeting. Everybody sits on the floor and everybody sits around and we just share what we're grateful for. And it's real cute because two or three people always mention, well, this is what it was like in the beginning days. This is how AA started in somebody's living room with people sitting around on the floor. And we've had those kind of meetings forever. And it's really, really great. Our history, if it were, I failed history. I didn't like history. Don't like anything about history. Don't like dates. Don't like numbers. I just barely got through it. I'm a high school dropout, but I just barely got through it. When I went to looking at how we all started, by the way, we're moving from one house to another, and last Saturday there was about 20, 25 girls and guys showed up at my house and they packed me. And I went to look for my books. Tuesday night I thought, well, I better get my stuff out and get my outline in my head. And I literally, this is how dumb you can get sometimes. I went into the office where I watched them pack, opened the door for my books, and it was as empty, all these shelves were empty. And I saw them packing that stuff, and it just didn't, anyway. So everything that I usually do this with is gone. So I have punted. This is plan, I'm about plan Z right now, I think. Al-Anon faced is alcoholism, the first edition. Now, I understand you can't get that anymore, but I'm not sure. If you can, get it. I think you can order it, maybe. It has the very best about where you and I come from, as Al-Anons, where we come from, how this all started. And it's incredible. And that's where I've got all my little notes and all my stuff. So I'm really doing some of this by memory and some of it by picking up some other books. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And AA Comes of Age is some of the best history that we have. It tells about how AA has started, but of course it does start and tells you how Al-Anon is involved in a little bit. Now this is a kicker. This is First Steps, the first 35 years of Al-Anon. There's all kinds of good things in there. Excellent stuff. And they discontinued it. I was just a if you haven't got one, I would urge you to order one because sooner or later they're going to run out and they're not going to print them anymore unless there's a big outcry from a bunch of us. That's our history. Al-Anon Family Groups. This is our first, this is a brand new book. They've changed the title. This was 1989. In this book about our history is page 1, 2, 3 and a half, our history, where we've come from. There's just something to me that's tilt. If we don't know the miracle we've come from, we won't cherish it, in my opinion. I'm just in awe of this fellowship. It has saved my life. It has saved my husband's life. It recently saved my ex-husband's life. It has saved my children's life. Hopefully it will save my grandchildren's life. It has saved my niece, my nephew, my brother. I mean, on and on and on. If we don't know about it, if we don't cherish it, I think there's something about your gratitude right here. There's something missing if we don't understand this. And this would be, if I could do one thing while I was on earth, it would be this, is to pass on the magnificence of this program. Dr. Bob. I think their personalities came into our steps. They came into our traditions, as she was talking about, and that's been passed down. There were two cute Vermont people. Evidently, and I don't know about Yankees, and I guess Vermont's in Yankee land. Anything north of Oklahoma is Yankee to me. And evidently, they're very reserved people, very quiet people. So to be drunk and have a good time was really against their nature. However, there's stories about Dr. Bob, and there's stories about Bill Wilson in all of our literature. If you can pick that up and kind of go then with the flow about how it was passed down, you'll see why we have so much fun today. I mean, we have fun here. To be sad and in pain all the time, nobody would stay. And both these guys evidently had a cute personality, and they were kind of different. They molded our meetings. They molded the way it is for us today as we sit in this room. For instance, this is Dr. Bob. This is his, out of his book, and one of his nurses was talking about him. This is what she said. She was a surgical nurse. She helped him with the procedure. If things started to go bad in an operation, doctor would always remain very calm. He made us feel comfortable, and there was nothing to be hurried about. He was somewhat raspy. He could be soft. He could be low. The rougher the things got to going, the calmer he seemed to be. Everybody liked him. He was well respected. When he was drunk, everybody protected him because they liked him. He had a great sense of humor. This nurse says, we were doing a lumbar puncture. I, said the nurse, dropped the specimen. Instead of reporting her, he merely said, well, we'll just have to get some more. And when her supervisor inquired where they were going, why they were going through this complicated and tedious procedure again, he replied, well, I dropped the damn thing. She did not have to say anything, and he just looked at her and hushed her. She said, I don't know whether the supervisor believed him or not, and I don't care. I could have kissed the ground the man walked on. Period. She also recalled, I got to the OR one Sunday afternoon, and there was this intern. He kind of was hanging over and kind of just there. The patient was turned over on his abdomen, and Dr. Bob, who was a rectal surgeon, felt that there was no point in prepping them in the rectum. There's no point there to do anything because it's your rectum. The intern, who was a rather shy young man with his head in the clouds most of the time, was sort of leaning on the patient, using a hemostat to pull hairs out of the rectal area. It was as though he was plucking petals from a flower. She loves me. She loves me not. I always remember Dr. Bob saying, doctor. And the intern said, yes, doctor. And Dr. Bob said, just how in the hell would you like somebody pulling hairs out of your ass? So he was obviously a very blunt man also. Now, these two guys, their personalities have come into our meetings today, and this is the way they also describe out of this Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob's character undoubtedly had a strong influence in the shaping of meetings. As Akron said, as in Akron, and in the big difference between Akron and New York, Akron was, we did not tell our drinking histories at the meetings. We did not need to. A man's sponsor and Dr. Bob knew all the details. Frankly, we did not need to think it was anybody else's business. Besides, we already knew how to drink. What we wanted to do was learn how to get sober and stay sober. So that's how their meetings went. Well, then here comes Bill, the stockbroker, the wheeler dealer. I mean, he was always, you know, he was just a go-getter, and here's Bob, very soft and sweet. Bill said he was in favor of having an AA member qualify or tell how he became an alcoholic. And this idea did attract some people, and it did enable some of them to grow. When the qualifying business began, it took some getting used to on our part, said one of the members. I remember one time when we were at a meeting at King's School, some people came in from Cleveland. They clapped and made a lot of noise. To us, it seemed strange and offensive. But we still got, gradually we opened up under Bill's persuasive influence, but we still not care for it when people got too carried away by their own voices and making their stories too sensational. So you see, here was the Vermont, and then here was Bill. Let's have a good time. Almost everybody remembered that Dr. Bob and Ann had regular seats. Pretty well back on one side. Ann was near the outside, close to the door. I could go to the door, and there I could see Bill, and I could see Wally, and I could see Ethel, and I could see Dr. Bob. They were all sitting in their seats. Nobody thought about sitting in their seats. And I would bet you right now, and I did a meeting last night in my home group, and I made the same statement. I said, we all have our seats. I sit on the right over there. When you first walk in the door, I sit on that front row. Now, a couple of the guys go into another room and get this big, soft, cushiony chair with arms, and they bring it in there so I can sit on it. They're just trying to suck up, number one. But number two, I do have a bad back, and so they're really trying to take care of me, and they're doing it by showing respect. And nobody sits in that seat. They wouldn't even think about sitting in that seat. So that's my seat. Right next to me sits a girl named Carol. She sat there for 5 years. On this other end is a girl named Maria. She sits there. And Bobby sits right behind me, and Louisa sits behind her. And, you know, I mean, you can tell where people sit. Now, the importance of that in our meetings is, if I'm not there, they look, and they wonder where I'm at, because I'm always there. Do you know how much security there is in looking, and they're always there, in their seat? That's our security. That started way before I had the idea. Now, there's some people in my group that would tell you, it's my idea. It's not my idea. It's every group in the world. We have our seats. They belong to us. We have earned them, most of us. I certainly have. Now, in the beginning, these early folks, you know, I keep remembering, and I try to keep remembering, I keep trying to tell everybody I sponsor, do you realize that when you got ill with your disease of Al-Anonism, when you got here, you walked in the door, the lights were on, that coffee was made, and the seats were here, and the 12 steps were on the wall. Do you understand that, says I to everybody I sponsor. Stop and think about that. It was here for us. We didn't have to stomp our way through. We didn't have to die to do it. When we got here, the lights were on and the coffee was made, waiting on us. Do any of us in our selfish and self-centeredness think about how it got here? No. We're hurting and we want to get well. We want somebody to help me, relieve me. When you stop and think about the beginnings of this, what a miracle it is. How many of you have ever been to Akron, Ohio? You know, I mean, it's just not Akron. Who's going to go to Akron? I mean, you got to have a reason to go to Akron. Not this far. We're just not going to go there. That miracle got here. It got here. 60 years later, it's here for us. Now, this is what they did when they first started. They went to Dr. Bob's house. His wife, Ann, was a very sweet woman, a Christian woman, I assume. She read the good book, as they called it, all the time. Bob and Bill got there, and Ann would tell them, well, maybe y'all ought to just get something on your minds every morning before you start off. Because they would sit up hours at night talking about their drinking and what was happening and all the similarities that they were having. And the next morning, Ann would get up and make coffee for them in the kitchen, and they'd start in again. And she'd say, well, let's do something. Let's start out. So she would read, and they would start doing things. The first things that they read, the first things that they studied in AA before the 12 steps came around, were out of the good book. They read the Book of James. If you will read the Book of James, you will see a lot of our program right there, where it came, all the steps came from there. 2 Corinthians, the chapter on love, whatever that is. And they got a book called Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And they read these things, and they put these things in their minds and in their lives and how it all started out. Dr. Bob noted that there were no 12 steps at the time of the beginning of these meetings, and our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of. Later, they said they were convinced that the answer to their problem was in the good book. To some of us older ones, the part we found absolutely essential were, well, here it is, Sermon on the Mount, the 13th chapter, 1 Corinthians, the book of James. This was the beginning of AA's flying blind. They had the Bible, and they had other precepts of the Oxford group, and they had their own instincts. They were working out the AA program at that coffee table every morning, the 12 steps, without quite even knowing it. As Dr. Bobby crawled, I didn't write the 12 steps. I had nothing to do with writing them. But I think I had probably something to do with them indirectly. There was hardly a night during the 3 months that Bill stayed with us in the summer of 35 that we didn't sit up to 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning talking. It would be hard for me to conceive that during these nightly discussions around our kitchen table that nothing was said that didn't influence these 12 steps. We already had the basic ideas, not in terse and tangled form, but we got them as a result of studying the good book. We must have had them. Since then, we have learned from experience that they are very important in maintaining our sobriety. All this happened, Dr. Bob said, at a time when everybody was broke, awfully broke. It was probably much easier for us to be successful when broke than it would have been if we'd had a checking account apiece. I know now that it was providentially arranged. I call that divine appointment. when they were meeting at Dr. Bob's house, and they went and they'd get another drunk, and there's horror stories about how they got them sober back then. They would, I can't remember what they gave them. You remember, Rusty, it was sauerkraut and tomato juice and paraldehyde, and they'd bring the drunks in, they'd get them sober, and they'd take them upstairs and make them surrender and take the third step in an hour, and they'd come back down, they'd be quiet, and they'd be shaking, you know, they took the third step. And then they'd just make them write their inventory right there, and they'd send them out the next couple of days to make their amends, and in 2 or 3 days, they're through. And that's how they did it in the beginning. Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, said that he'd always know when there's a new drunk in the house, he'd come in and smell that paraldehyde, and he'd know he didn't have a bedroom for that night because they'd kick him out, put the drunk in there. All this was going on. These drunks are coming and going and coming and going. The neighborhood did not like a bunch of drunks coming and going in their neighborhood. Now, this is 1935. Drunkards were looked upon as the scum of the earth. It was not a sickness. There was no Betty Ford. There was no Liz Taylor. I mean, it was, you were looked upon as being, well, as my mama called it, my grandma, total white trash. Just white trash. And people stayed away from you. Well, I was just heartbroken. Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, he and I were traveling on a plane, and he began to tell me some things one time. And I mean, I started crying. The thought that I had, it never had occurred to me what was going on. Their neighbors started shunning them. Their neighbors didn't want all these people here and told them so. The preacher came to their house and said, "We don't want you coming back to church." I mean, they were just shunned. And yet they kept on those drunks. You know what? If that had shunned us, we'd have stopped doing it. We're people pleaser. We'd have done whatever it was to take, you know. And where would we, you know, where would our fellowship be today, you know, if it was left up to us? But they just kept on. And that was sad. I just thought about him and his sister. He had a sister named Sue. And, you know, the kids at school, you know how awful kids at school can be. They said terrible things about them. They didn't have any friends. That's a horror. And, you know, when you and I come in, the lights are on and the coffee's made. We don't even think about it. And then we sit here and bitch and moan and carry on. It's just, and if you don't know these things, sometimes you don't have the gratitude for those who went before us. And this is how they kind of got together and how they started going. As Bill put it, scarcity evening passed in the summer of 35, that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women, happy in their release and constantly talking how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. The first ones always were looking for the newcomer. Whether there was a failure or not made no difference. They made an effort to bring the man's family into the spiritual way of living, a foreshadowing forerunner of Al-Anon, and thus relieving much worry and suffering. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart one night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone and everyone interested in the spiritual way of life. This, of course, was Wednesday night at T. Henry Williams' house. T. Henry Williams was a good friend of AA. They called themselves, at that point in time, the Alcoholic Squad. They went around trying to gather up alcoholics. I mean, they didn't wait for anybody to call. There wasn't nobody to call. They went out hunting. They were hunting. They'd call the doctors. They would call the police department. They'd go to hospitals. They was hunting. And Dr. Bob was in a great place because he worked in the hospital, and so they'd have what he called a new pigeon. They all would just, I mean, they'd just knocking each other down and go make 12-step call. I mean, they were. They didn't say to them, "Do you have insurance? Can we drive you to the next treatment center?" I mean, they were knocking each other down. It was great. This is what they did. Another thing they did is they handed out little address books with everybody's name on it and in it. Very few people had phones because they were broke, so they couldn't call. Do you know how you and I are? We'd stump our toe. "Oh, I've got to call a sponsor." You know. "Oh, I don't feel good today. I've got to call a sponsor." You know. "Oh, he hurt my feelings. I've got to call a sponsor." I mean, we just use that phone. These people didn't have a phone. They had very little money. "We were all too poor," said they. But the ones who had phone numbers, they were very busy. And when they said drop in us on any time, they meant it. They meant it. As shown by Ann's daily calls.
which meant everything to me, said Henrietta D. She's one of the newer ones. The telephone played an important part in AA at the very beginning. Now, Anne, Dr. Bob's wife, she would tend to all the women as they came in. She loved the newcomer. That was her whole purpose, was newcomer. And there's a story in here, I won't read it, but it talks about they had been around now for several months. It's New Year's Eve. This started in summer. It's New Year's Eve. They're gathering people up. She got two new dresses. They were going to have a gathering at New Year's Eve, and one of the girls got a new dress, too. She came to her. She was so excited she was going to wear a new dress, and she asked Anne which one of them she's going to wear. And Anne Smith said, I don't believe I'll wear either one of them. I think I'll wear the same black dress because there's so many new women that don't have anything to wear. People saw Anne Smith the first 2 years in the same black dress. Can you imagine? I mean, you won't see me in this dress for the next 10 years, I guarantee you. I mean, it's too important that I look cute. She had the same black dress that she would not want any newcomer to feel out of place because they didn't have the money. I just cried and wept the first time I saw it. It was like, man, I'm already trying to get her to take me to Nordstrom's. I don't need any clothes. I don't need any clothes. And this poor woman, you know, she was such a blessed woman. They call her the mother of AA, and I'm quite sure this is true. She got very little recognition as far as I'm concerned, and probably that's exactly the way she wanted it. Me, you know, recognize me, recognize me. Hey, recognize me, recognize me. Oh, ho, ho, recognize me. You know, and this woman didn't want it. She just was really a very, I think she was an angel on earth, I don't know. Contact by phone and face-to-face was very important. The only trouble we had, that Wednesday nights were too far apart. I could see Clarence getting busy, said Henrietta D., and I would say, let's go visit someone. And we'd just pick up and go down to see them. They might be sitting down to dinner or wherever it was, but they would welcome us, and we knew we were welcome. So they stayed close-knit, close-tight with each other. They went places. The meetings after the meetings before the meetings, Saturday afternoon meetings like this one. We felt that it was a privilege to be with Bob and Ann. We remembered how poor they were, too, but sometimes they were just having bread and milk for dinner. Now, they spent a lot of money on formaldehyde, on sauerkraut and tomato sauce, and they drank bread and milk for dinner. I'm telling you, the lights were on, the coffee was made when I got here. I didn't eat bread and milk so y'all could get sober and so that y'all could come to Alna. I wouldn't do that, I don't think. I'm pretty sure that's why God didn't pick me. But, I mean, you know, they would sacrifice so that those lights would be on and the coffee was made when you got here. And I think about that, and I just, it's incredible to me. Sometimes they were having bread and milk. Well, there was always some more bread and milk for us, said she. And Anne would serve it just as graciously as if it had been a turkey dinner. You know, the sentence in the big book that we were people saved from a shipwreck, that was really the way it was. We had that closeness. This was the pioneering group, and you weren't absolutely sure if it worked or not, so you couldn't possibly overdo it. She says we really were like the shipwreck people, and that's talked about a lot, and I want to read that real quick because I think it's some of the finest literature that we have. And this was in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that this pioneering group got together and wrote, and it says, there is a solution. Chapter 2 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill and Bob. Nearly all of us recovered. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations represented, as well as many political, economical, social, and religious backgrounds. If we took a poll here this afternoon, I imagine we'd find this. From all parts of the country, all kinds of religion. We are people who would normally not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner. The moment after rescue from a shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. but then in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact, one of my favorite, I say this all the time about every paragraph I read, but this is one of my favorite paragraphs. The tremendous fact that every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Not just the ship going down, we've all been on that ship, but we found a common solution. We have a way out, which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly, and I'm adding, sisterly, and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. This was written, we read this all the time, this was written at this table we just got through talking about. It was there that they hammered it out, and they stuck together like glue. Families. They talk about families, over and over and over here. Is it time? Okay. I'm going to read this, and then we'll break. Thank you. This is some little tidbits. I think it was so cute. I didn't know whether I was going to read it or not, but since it's break time, that's exactly what I want to close on. It says, they talk about Dr. Bob and his stories and how some of the things get passed down. Have y'all heard the word pigeons? As sponsorees, we call them sponsorees. Pigeons was Dr. Bob's idea. He would say to the guys around at the Wednesday night meeting, well, I've got a pigeon over in room so-and-so at the hospital. I need some of y'all to call on. And they would just knock themselves down out to go see the pigeon. And that has been called pigeon for 60 years now. Some of us have changed it to sponsorees. And I really didn't know until I was looking at this time that's where it came from, Dr. Bob. These are some little stories, little tidbits about Dr. Bob I thought was real cute. And it's like the shotgun AAs, the ones you have to get here right before, you know, with a shotgun at their back. He said it was like the farmer. He brought a man into the doctor's office. He said, here, doctor, I shot my son-in-law full of buckshot. The doctor said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself shooting your son-in-law. Well, doc, he wasn't my son-in-law until I shot him. And that's the analogies he would use in the meetings. God never forgetting us. This is a story he would tell about that. One man was telling another man about the trouble his son got into. The second fellow said, you know, Jim, if that was my son, I'd kick him out. The first fellow said, if he was your son, I'd kick him out too. I have used that 1,000 times because I can't kick my kids out. I can't. But if you will tell me what you would do if you had a drunk kid at home, sometimes that helps me ooze them out. How about getting out of AA what you put into it? Doc told this story about another farmer. If you wanted to work the harvest, he says, what are you paying? The man asked. I'll pay you what you're worth, the farmer said. No, thanks, said the fella. I'll be damned if I work for that little. That's exactly what is a good analogy about how much you want to get out of this fellowship, exactly what you put in it. How many of you are here today? You know, you're putting in it, you're going to get something out of it. Explain about prayer. He said this. He would tell how the camels in a caravan would kneel down in the evening and the men would unload their burdens. In the morning, they would kneel down again and the men would put the burdens back on. It's the same with prayer, Dr. Bob said. We get our needs to unload at night, and in the morning when we get on our knees again, God gives us just the load we will be able to carry for that day. I love that. I remember a story he repeated over and over and over. It was about this boy who burned his hand. The doctor dressed it and bandaged it. When he took the bandage off, the boy's hand was healed. The little boy said, you're wonderful, doctor. You cure everybody, don't you? No, I don't, the doctor said. I dress the wound. God heals it. He sets the still, and that's what happens. We will take about a 15-minute break? And for a stretch and a drink and a potty or whatever, and then we'll get back. Thanks. Following the meetings at King's School, now we're still in Akron, Ohio, because Bill has not yet left Akron to go back to New York to start AA there. So they're talking about the wives, what they did in the very beginning there. They went downstairs, as the meetings were going upstairs, and they had coffee and donut. They were allowed to wash the dishes, make coffee, organize picnics, and things like that. And years ago, the women sat on one side of the room, and the other men sat on the other side of the room, and that's the way it is.
And then it talks about Anne's concern for the newcomer, how she really dragged them in, how she was constantly looking for the newcomer. She called one of the other newer ladies, and she said to me, Anne called me one night, she said, Dorothy, people have been awfully good to you, haven't they? You've been pretty lucky, and you've made so many friends. Of course, I agreed, 100%. Don't you think that you could pass that on a little bit? There's a new woman sitting over there in the corner, and nobody's talking to her. That's the one thing I've tried to remember all these years. If I didn't learn anything else from Anne, I learned that it was the new people that counted. To really try and make them feel welcome and wanted. That's the one way I can pay back. Now, I have been told to pass it on ever since I got to this fellowship. Now, sometimes I think it's my sponsor's idea, and sometimes I don't think she's real smart. Especially if it involves some action on my part. But when I go back to look and see, I believe, absolutely with all my heart and soul, with every fiber of my heart,